Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann. I'll begin with a featured article from the magazine. Want to do less time? A prison consultant might be able to help you. For a price, a new breed of fixer is teaching convicts how to reduce their sentence, get placed in a better facility, and make the most of their months behind bars. This is a story by Jack Hitt. Hugo Mejia remembers when his Xanax habit ran off the rails. It was around when his small-time Bitcoin cash exchange business blew up, and he was handling millions of dollars, and the whole thing turned into what federal prosecutors called a money laundering operation. It all started so innocently. Back when Bitcoin was new, there were people who wanted to flip Bitcoin for dollars and others who needed dollars for Bitcoin. In these early days of cryptocurrency, going from dollars to Bitcoin or vice versa wasn't as easy as it is now, but Mejia figured out how to make it simple enough. He became a human ATM, balancing a trade of Bitcoin with a trade of dollars and charging a little vig each way. I'd make $150 for the day, he said, and that was my day. That was my hustle. Word got around, and Mejia got new customers, some of whom wanted to change quite a bit of money, more money than he was accustomed to. Now, I'm not a stupid person, he told me. I knew these individuals weren't involved in the horse and concession trade like they said. This was getting out of control, and I was in too deep. He was putting 2,000 miles a week on his car, picking up suitcases filled with as much as $150,000, even $250,000 in cash, which he would have to take home until he could work out the Bitcoin flip. He asked me, so if you had that kind of money, Jack, for example, if I may, under your bed, could you sleep comfortably, really? Suddenly, he was demanding a lot more from his Xanax. It went from nervousness and stress to fear and depression, he said, all of which found creative ways to express itself. One day, he woke up to find his eyes were bleeding from the inside. Mejia was diagnosed with retinopathy and began getting regular injections into his eyeballs to save his sight. Then, one very early morning last winter, it all fell apart. Some 25 federal agents from a joint Homeland Security and IRS task force stormed his house in Ontario, California. They pounced on my home like I was El Chapo, he said. His aunt and mother were handcuffed, and Mejia was detained in his den by agents who grilled him for hours. Mejia, a U.S. Army veteran and former school teacher, insists he had never messed up like this before. He always thought of himself as a hard-working, regular guy. Mejia is good-looking in a middle-aged, Vin Diesel sort of way. He certainly didn't recognize himself in the Department of Justice news release that was issued shortly after his arrest, painting him as an international financial mastermind facing as much as 25 years in federal prison. He also couldn't get a straight answer about anything. He hadn't even been formally arrested yet. He was a target in a much bigger investigation. The federal authorities really wanted the identity of a certain guy whose money Mejia had handled. But Mejia says he never met this person. He quickly suggested a proffer, a deal, but the feds wanted to know more about his client. Mejia insisted he didn't know any more and found himself in an impossible situation. If he didn't tell them something, he was facing serious time. Of course, he hired a lawyer, one who described himself as a cryptocurrency expert. But soon, Mejia discovered that their expensive sessions mostly involved Mejia's tutoring his own attorney in the complexities of the blockchain. He was already going to plead out and sensed that he was in the grip of an inescapable process. So he fired that lawyer and the next one and wound up being represented by a court-appointed attorney. In the meantime, he started scouring the internet madly to see what he could learn about his future. "I would scare myself watching videos of jail," he said. Maya had entered one of the Kubler-Rossian periods of the prison-bound self-terrorism. But then Maya stumbled on a video of a guy named Justin Paperny, himself a former financial criminal, who was all over YouTube dispensing so-you're-going-to-prison advice in a confident, peppy patter, answering questions newly charged defendants might not even think to ask. Maya loved this guy and spent hours watching his videos. "It would kind of calm my anxiety," he said. The big fears started to seem less terrifying. He learned that he would most likely be going to a low-security prison where violence is not even common, let alone rape or anything like that. Justin Paperny leads White Collar Advice, a firm of 12 convicted felons, each with their own consulting specialty based on where they serve time and their own sentencing experiences. After a deep dive into Paperny's YouTube lessons, Mahan knew he had to hire him. This was 21st century America, and this was precisely what he needed, a prison consultant. Maybe you've heard of these consultants recently. After a prominent felon is sentenced, a spate of stories often appear about these backstage fixers for the wealthy, consultants who can help get a client into prisons that one might prefer, say a prison that has superior schooling or CrossFit-level gyms or lenient furlough policies or better-paying jobs or other refined specialties. The federal prison in Otisville, New York, for example, is also known as Federal Jewish Heaven because of its good kosher food, decent gefilte fish, they say, and the rugelach, not bad. When those Varsity Blues parents were busted for paying backdoor operatives to engineer their kids' college admissions, it was also reported that many hired prison consultants to game out the aftermath. Paperny's business is a natural market outgrowth of a continuing and profound shift in America's judicial system. Almost everyone facing charges is forced to plead guilty or face an angry prosecutor who will take you to trial. In 2021, 98.3% of federal cases ended up as plea bargains. It's arguable that in our era of procedural dramas and endless Law and Order reruns, speedy and public trials are more common on television than in real-life courthouses. What people like Maya have to deal with as they await sentencing is a lot of logistics. The idea of a prison consultant might conjure an image of an insider, broker, or fixer, but they're really more like an SAT tutor, someone who understands test logic and the nuances of unwritten rules. Yet prison consulting also involves dealing with a desolate human being who has lost almost everything, family, friends, money, reputation, and done it in such a way that no one gives a damn. So they're also a paid-for best friend, plying their clients with Tony Robbins-style motivational insights, occasionally mixed with powerful sessions about the nature of guilt and shame. On television, the journey to prison is nearly instantaneous, a jump cut to a slamming cell door. But in the real world, it's a set of steps, routine bureaucratic actions that involved interviews, numerous forms to complete, and dates with officials. A lawyer is your legal guide to staying out of prison, but once that becomes inevitable, a prison consultant is there to chaperone you through the bureaucracies that will eventually land you in your new home, easing your entry into incarceration, and sometimes even returning you to the outside, utterly changed. When I first started talking to Maya and sitting in on his consultations about a year ago, there was rarely a meeting when he wouldn't slip in some version of the story of his crime. Mostly, he tried to emphasize that he wasn't as guilty as his plea made him out to be, that he wasn't really deep down a criminal at all. He would tell it over and over again. It would pop up in almost any conversation, often wedged into a conversation after a "for the record," or "I just want to say," or "Jack, you might be interested in this. The tone and the desperation of that repeated story, I was in over my head, I'm not a bad guy, always had a kind of curdling effect on the listener. It was tiresome, but also on some level it felt familiar. In much less calamitous circumstances, we've all vamped our way through some variation of it. It's every culprit's first draft of his own story, because it's human nature. It's irresistible. In The Shawshank Redemption, when Tim Robbins first insists that he did nothing wrong, Morgan Freeman beams, "Hell, you'll fit right in then," he said. "Everybody's innocent in here." One of the first things Papernee advises a client like Maya is to stop doing that, especially before sentencing. You pleaded guilty already. You did it. Own it. Because the vamping will almost certainly annoy any judge or civil servant who hears it, and you'll wind up with a much longer sentence. That's arguably the most crucial piece of advice that Papernee provides to his clients, for the simple reason that when you're going to prison, you have to formally tell your story to all kinds of people. The storytelling officially begins a few weeks after a guilty plea or a conviction by trial. In a sit-down interview with a law enforcement officer whose specialty is writing up a pre-sentencing report, which will be given to the presiding judge. The descriptions of the crime come largely from the plea agreement, which is naturally centered on the proposition that you are a heinous criminal and a moral fugitive. Think of a Wikipedia biography that tells the story of the worst moment of your life with everything else about you salted away in footnotes. This is what the sentencing judge will read before deciding precisely how long you'll be confined. And it's a story that will follow you throughout your stay with the state. They call the pre-sentencing report the Bible in prison because it's one of the first things a case manager or counselor will rely upon, Papernee says. It'll influence early release, your half-house time, your bunk, your job, and so on. And the person writing that story for you is someone who's already heard every version of the breathy, stem-winding explanation imaginable. They're used to us saying, "We're sorry because we got caught." Papernee said during one of these meetings with Maya, or, "We paid back the money because we don't want to go to jail," or, "We cooperated to avoid prison." Many lawyers send their clients into this interview with the standard legal advice to say as little as possible and limit the damage. Good advice during an arrest or even in the courtroom. But this is the most important interview the defendant will ever have, and you'd be stunned at how many defendants don't prepare, Papernee said. This is a chance for you to change the narrative. At the moment Maya says hello to the interviewer, all the material the officer has on the table is focused on the crime. And if Maya surrenders to the mighty tug of self-exoneration, then the focus of the story remains the legal transgressions, and the biography instantly turns into a profile of a career criminal. Instead, Papernee and his colleagues coax a full biography out of each client. They encourage you to write out a full life story in the form of a letter, then rewrite it with editors working through every line, then ask you to read it over and over until eventually you sit down for a mock interview. By the time the officer is conducting the real interview, the story he hears is a full autobiography with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And somewhere in there is this speed bump in the narrative, your crime. During these early sessions, a client will often spend time with Brad Rouse, who is the firm's expert in written narrative. In his previous career, Rouse was a well-known theater director in New York, a Harvard graduate whose credits include the 2012 musical about Andy Warhol, Pop, and Billy Porter's 2005 one-man show, Ghetto Superstar. His 2001 revival of the Harold Arlen musical, Bloomer Girl, earned him a segment on CBS's 60 Minutes, too. But those aren't his real credentials. Like everyone on Papernee's consulting team, Rouse has served time in federal lockup. About 15 years ago, he fell heavily into drug use and ended up dealing 5, 6, 7 types of drugs until some 10 agents burst into his West Village apartment. Often when clients first encounter Rouse, they're in that post-plea misery marked by social paralysis, 1,000-yard stares, and near catatonia. It's a delicate time. Suicide is a real risk. I remember when I piled furniture up in front of my window because I'm on the 6th floor, he said. I had such a desire to kill myself. Many of the people he talks to have basically been law-abiding, high achievers who justified crossing some line for the first time, lost everything, and were staring into a near future of incarceration. They feel like they've dropped through the dance floor and it's over, told me. That's where the conversation often starts. Scattered details eventually gathered into coherence. It's like directing a one-man show, he said, except the audience is also one person, the judge. Throughout the spring, Maya was kicking drafts of the letter back and forth with Rouse and Papernick, and I read them as they became more and more refined. Maya's pre-sentencing interview was scheduled in June, and by early summer, a different character began to come into focus. A 15-year-old striver who rode a bus for an hour to work as a liquor store clerk boy and who once won a competition with his King Lear monologue, who then left home to become a reconnaissance specialist in the Army before returning to Los Angeles for college and eventually a master's in business administration. Maya's story, which is about half as long as this article, has a Hallmark TV movie quality to it. But the result is intriguing, almost like one of those standout obituaries, only the subject is still alive. One unexpected feature of these narratives is how much of the story hints at a rehabilitation that has yet to fully manifest. More than a few felons awaiting sentencing told me that they were already paying back their victims. Many just get jobs. One former CEO I spoke with was working for minimum wage, while others have started entire businesses and kept them operating straight through a lengthy prison term. Part of the reason Papernick pushes his clients to get back to work, any work, is to provide some good, upright citizen material for the pre-sentencing report, but also to break out of the paralysis that Rouse describes. After Papernick got caught, he remembers letting whole days and weeks go by, ordering 2 double cheeseburgers, 2 fries and a shake from In-N-Out while compulsively playing online chess until the one-time trim USC college baseball player staggered around his house, topping 200 pounds. If you've ever listened to a podcast, maybe you've heard an ad for MeUndies. The company was started by a man named Jonathan Shrokran, just before he was sentenced to a short prison term in 2014. He hired Papernick on his way in and ran the company from prison, later expanding it after meeting a bank robber named Grease, who, it turns out, was a marketing savant. Look it up. Worth the read. So by the time Maya was prepping for his pre-sentencing interview, he'd already set up several new enterprises, one of them an online store that sells Rolexes, which can be paid for with crypto, watchholder.com. But how the letter handles the present tense is the most vivid transformation. All of the self-exoneration has been slyly edited out. The first-person confessional tone is searing. I write this letter feeling humiliated and heartbroken, Maya begins. I know now that I crossed a red line that exists for important reasons. At first, exchanging cash for Bitcoin seemed legitimate. I see now that I was wrong. He closes by addressing the judge directly. It was important for me to show you who I really am. I accept full responsibility for my action and will never return to your courtroom as a criminal defendant. The tenor here feels pious, as though somehow the whole process has reverted to the religious origins of incarceration. Guilt, confession, penitence. This legacy vocabulary of criminal justice calls back to a time when confinement was about reform and salvation, before modern punishment turned exclusively on physical torture, the amateur savagery of shower rape jokes, random beatdowns, the cruelty of solitary. But put all the parts together in the buoyant takeaway for any judge reading it's that maybe his job is already done. Nothing isolates one's crime and all the moral dereliction that comes with it, quite like a story in which the jail time, which hasn't even started, already seems to be receding into the past. When the rapper Statquo was busted on charges of participating in a scheme to steal millions of frequent flyer miles, naturally he hired a lawyer, but still he was freaking out. So I went on YouTube and I was just looking up, you know, what do you do when you've been named in an indictment? Statquo, legally Stanley Benton, came across the same videos Maya found and started, in his words, binge-watching. Every topic that was haunting him, what to do when you're actually indicted, picking a lawyer, preparing a sentencing memorandum, each had its own video, narrated with Paperny's trademark confidence. Okay, Statquo remembers thinking, this guy knows what he's talking about, so he hired him. On the morning I caught up with Statquo, he had just gotten back from a Pasadena kitchen where he was cooking breakfast for the homeless 3 mornings a week. He started doing it years ago, long before he got in trouble, and stayed with it. Actually, it's important for me to see that, you know what I mean? Because you know this Hollywood stuff that I'm in, you will lose sight of reality sometimes, you know. My friends' houses look like malls. His full story was pitch perfect. He'd never tangled with the law before, and he has a family. Still, he had the usual long-winded take on his own innocence. His friend had offered him discounted airline tickets, and he bought them without knowing that this friend had gotten them by hacking into other people's accounts and stealing their miles. But when Statquo sat down to work on his narrative, he totally got it. He knew that anyone walking into a pre-sentencing interview is presumed to be a hardened criminal. But a black rapper? My case was out of Dallas, Texas. And let's be honest here, he said. Not the most progressive state for a black man. And listen, I'm not Drake black. I'm like Shaka Zulu black. You know what I'm saying? 3 of the other defendants who used these stolen miles got real time. One guy got up there trying to explain all kinds of expletive and making excuses. That's the wrong thing to do. But he didn't have anyone to tell him, because that's just your natural instinct when you get in front of somebody. Judge, wait a minute, man. I ain't do nothing. Come on now. Hold on, man. You know I'm just out here. Slam. The guy was sentenced to 2.5 years. My judge saw me differently, he said. She's like, based on what I've read about you, you shouldn't even be in here. In the sentencing hearing, Judge Jane Boyle said aloud, I wonder if he even should have been prosecuted. And she said, I'd like to give you 6 months probation, but I can't. Then she turned to a court officer for clarification. Do I have to give him, she asked, 1 year probation? Informed that the guidelines required at least 1 year of probation, she imposed that exactly. That's because she was able to read my story, he said. Much of Paperny's advice comes from his own attempts to avoid prison when the Ponzi scheme he enabled collapsed. After being nabbed, he figured he would outsmart the feds with a series of artful dodges and deceptions. In the midst of constructing this web of lies, Paperny insisted that he take a lie detector test. I immediately Googled for information on polygraph examinations. Paperny writes in his self-published confessional, Lessons from Prison. He found a $350 online course which taught him all the ostensibly proven techniques to evade the lie detector. By tightening my sphincter when answering questions, he wrote, I supposedly could manipulate the machine's findings of truth to suit my purpose. And yet, even though he practiced so fervently and then squeezed my innards when appropriate. The polygraph administrator informed him afterward that the machine indicated, with an accuracy measurement of better than 99.99%, that he was lying. "Justin," he added, "you're going to prison." Once that reality set in, Papperny prepared the same way everyone does and how his clients still do, Googling what happens when you go to prison. He learned a jumble of information, but then the day came. Papperny reported to the Taft Federal Prison Camp in California, changing his street clothes for a prison outfit. He quickly discovered that there are lots of rules in prison that Quora doesn't have the answers to, and routines you have to discover by yourself. Soon enough, he met people and was told about people. There was a guy known as Dopey, another known as Roadrunner. He heard about a mysterious figure named the Kingpin, who had served the longest and hardest time. And then there was Drew, the hustler on his floor, who lured Papperny into accepting a contraband mattress, a dangerous first step because getting caught by the guards doing anything shady can easily win you an extended sentence. It was all dizzying, so Papperny decided to lie low and do what most inmates do: exercise, try to stay out of trouble. After a few days, the Kingpin was in the TV room and introduced himself. His name was Michael Santos, and he was busted for dealing in 1987 at the height of President Ronald Reagan's war on drugs. For his first offense at age 23, Santos was sent to federal prison for 45 years. Whatever Papperny might have been expecting, a battle-scarred lifer, a guy who could turn a Bic pen into a shiv, Santos wasn't it. Instead, he was a self-educated man whose years of reading transformed him into something far beyond your typical jailhouse lawyer, more of a jailhouse philosopher concerned with the metaphysics of confinement. Santos wanted to know if Papperny had ever read The Divine Comedy. In Dante's epic poem, he said, Virgil offered Dante a way out of the forest. Santos encouraged him not to worry so much about the softball league or the card games or all the other time wasters available to prisoners who instinctively believe that their years behind bars are meant to be useless. He encouraged Papperny to read Aristotle and to know thyself. He told him he should really read Sun Tzu, too, and learn how to know thy enemy. Like any sane convict, Papperny thought, you're kidding me. That's the wisdom of the centuries? Are you serious? Papperny wondered what the point was of all this Reader's Digest philosophy, but he found the books interesting. Who, he wondered, was this his enemy? Maybe, Santos told Papperny, the enemy is not a who. Maybe it's a what, he said. Maybe it's a prison term. Maybe it's an unfulfilling career that leads you to misery, or to bad decisions that land you in prison. At the time, Papperny was dealing with a lot of practical prison problems. He was working in the kitchen under the thumb of an aggressive inmate who trafficked liberally in Holocaust denial. And then there was Santos slowly teaching him to look past the office politics of prison and try to see his confinement as a bounty, a gift of years to prepare for what comes next. Think of prison as a business planning session, Santos told him. He'd been thinking that way for years. He'd already written several books about getting through prison. Papperny was due to get out a lot earlier than he was, Santos pointed out, so maybe he could get a jump on the obvious business idea, advising incoming felons on how best to handle the future of prison. When Papperny got out in 2009, he founded the business, with Santos joining on his release 4 years later. Today, Papperny and Santos are business partners, co-founders of White Collar Advice, and another business called Prison Professors, which is Santos's attempt to make their services and philosophy available to anyone, not just the white-collar felons who can afford their fees. Papperny told me those fees range from a few thousand dollars into the six figures. Santos's intention, long before he got out, was always much bigger than consulting with white-collar criminals, whom he described as merely the consumer side of the business. It's way more important to me to help the million people that are in prison who keep recidivating, he said. To that end, the other side of the business seeks to recreate for thousands of prisoners a certain encounter Paperny had not long after meeting Santos. When I went in, I was a fat, miserable, self-loathing, white-collar defendant, blaming everyone but myself, Paperny said, and adjusted to prison like you do, complaining and exercising 7-8 hours a day. Then the Taft prison camp philosopher sidled up to him at the gym one day, and Santos said to me, kind of joking, like, hey, bud, how much are people going to pay you to do those pull-ups when you get out? And I'm like, nobody. And it was an aha moment. Santos believes that inmates should think of confinement not as punishment, but as a continuing education for a future newly conceived. Our team, Paperny said, is a big proponent for avoiding recreational sports in prison, like softball, because unless you're going to be a softball player when you come home, then I don't think you should play softball 4 days a week. So every choice should relate to the life you want to live when you come home. When Santos did get out in 2013, he had to get familiar with a few new technologies, email, YouTube, basically the entire internet, but has since crafted a series of videos into a kind of freshman course on how to navigate prison. They're now available in all the prisons of Washington State and California, sometimes with the lure of sentence reduction for inmates who complete them. A former warden who knew Santos has helped install them in the parts of the prison, federal prison system. There are courses on setting goals, being accountable, attitude. You're not doing this for a GED certificate or to get a lower bunk pass or an extra bowl of Wheaties, Santos said, but to attain success as you define it. No matter how energized Santos might get talking about these expanding programs, he's still the jailhouse philosopher and epigrammatic inmate who can casually sit back at the end of a riff to tell you that he means to upend the entire American penitentiary system through the prisoners themselves, to bend the arc of the justice back to its history, when confinement was a call not for sadism and misery, but for contrition and deliverance. On the morning of Maya's sentencing last November, Maya met up with Paperny outside a coffee shop in Santa Ana. It was on an elegant block shaded by Chinese elm trees and crepe myrtle, with the stunning new Ronald Reagan federal building and the U.S. courthouse looming high above. Clerks and bailiffs with their belt badges and ID lanyards stood around drinking coffee. Maya showed up in a shiny new suit and introduced Paperny to his fiancée and his mother. He excitedly told us that the day before, his lawyer briefed him on some new clever arguments he would be using to ask for no jail time, just probation and home confinement. Paperny held out an open hand as if to slow things down and reminded Maya that the state was asking for nearly 5 years. It would be unusual for a judge to stiff a prosecutor by giving Maya no time at all. I wouldn't be surprised if you got 3 years, he said, trying to lower expectations. Paperny often finds himself at odds with the lawyers, mostly over details where he's relying on his own hard-won experience. The expectations game aside, Paperny was very concerned, agitated almost, about some specific advice he had written to Maya in emails and mentioned in numerous Zoom consults. There were a series of steps that had to be taken to secure the best possible outcome. There would be a back and forth between the two lawyers, and then the judge would pronounce a sentence. Right afterward, Maya had to make sure his lawyer asked two questions. Will the judge recommend a drug rehabilitation program? This can knock up to a year off a sentence. And would the judge recommend that Maya go to the low-security camp in Oregon? Inside, Judge Cormac Carney of Federal District Court reviewed the details of the crime and noted that his sentencing guidelines called for 57 to 71 months. Before he invited each side to make arguments about what the actual sentence should be, he spoke expansively about Maya's army experience, his hardship as a child, his eye disease. Clearly, some of version of Maya's biography had made its way to the judge's bench through the official bureaucratic channels that Papperny taught him to work. Then the prosecutor, Jason Pang, took the lectern and also admitted that he was impressed with Maya's story, noting that Maya's plea and expression of remorse were worthy things and that his military service was something that the court needs to consider. He recommended the low end of the sentencing guidelines. Maya's court-appointed attorney, Michael Crane, stepped up and dialed things all the way back to the case itself. Maya got busted, he explained, because a confidential informant got him talking about laundering money with crypto. Crane challenged the government's tactics, arguing that the CI was probably trying to lower his own sentence and that much of what Maya had said that implicated him in major felonies was really nothing more than puffery. You could almost feel the air in the room change. The morality play we'd all been watching had become a courtroom drama. He went on to pull from the week's headlines, pointing out that the day before, the QAnon shaman had gotten only 41 months in connection with the January 6th assault on the Capitol. With that, Crane asked for probation, no jail time. Well, after hearing from everybody, Carney said, I'm going to impose a custodial sentence of 36 months, 3 years. Maya's mother, who was seated in the gallery, lowered her head. The room went silent. Papperny sat up on the edge of the bench, grabbing the back of the pew in front and strained to make direct eye contact with Maya, who didn't forget. He leaned over and whispered to Crane, who asked if the judge would back Maya's request for drug rehab. I will make a strong recommendation for that, he said cheerfully. Then Crane said he had another request. Maya had asked him to be placed in a particular prison. My experience has been I don't think the court is going to recommend a particular facility, he said very politely. But if the court is inclined to do so, we have a name in mind. I'll do it, Carney said. It would be the Sheridan Federal Prison Camp that's in Oregon. I'll make that recommendation, the judge said. Papperny clenched his fist behind the bench and, safe from judicial review, pumped the smallest bit of air. Within hours, many news outlets ran the story about a major financial criminal getting hard time. Fox Business, man gets 3-year prison sentence for Bitcoin money laundering. But outside the courtroom, Papperny, full of pep, pulled Maya aside and explained the math. The day you show up, you'll get 5 months off for good time. That's 31 months, he said. And you'll get 9 months off for completing the drug program. That's 22. And you'll probably get 7 or 8 months in the halfway house. So it's 12 to 13 months. Throw in his health issues and the CARES Act, if it applies, and Maya might be home in less than a year. Papperny added that he had a few clients currently in Sheridan who would be there first thing, like a welcome wagon. It took a while before Maya brightened up and then grew chatty. He turned to me to marvel over this odd sense of relief he was feeling, of clarity, he said. Papperny whipped out a selfie stick, and he and Maya recorded a real-time video about what just happened and Maya's sense of purpose. Michael Santos, who was not there, was very much there. After Papperny turned off his phone, Maya's talk quickly shifted to his businesses, the future. He told his family he was going to make the businesses run while he's gone. He was in full planning mode. There was plenty of time before he had to report to prison for him to make it into a turnkey situation for his employees. Down at the corner, a fresh set of bailiffs and clerks sipped their lattes. Just past the Chinese elm trees, Maya took his fiancée's hand, and they walked away. The author, Jack Hitt, is the creator and co-host of the 2017 Peabody Award-winning podcast, Uncivil. He last wrote about sting operations to expose celebrity psychics. And now I'll read a letter of recommendation, The Misunderstood Art of Mischief. Motherhood taught me how to appreciate tiny gestures toward nonconformism. It's a story by Vauhini Vara. In kindergarten last school year, my son received an assignment to draw a portrait of his family. He sketched an abstract shape to start. It vaguely resembled an elephant, and I told him so. "It is," he said, and then his expression grew naughty. He had an idea just then. He drew a little form in front of it, which he said was himself. He and the elephant were both pink, his favorite color. The elephant appeared to be shouting with joy. He uploaded the image to the school's online learning platform. "This is me and my elephant," he said in an attached recording. "I rode on him once. It was so fun." This tiny gesture toward nonconformism, I admired it. As a child, I used to be the one who complained to the teacher when others broke with homework orthodoxy. My sister and I, children of Indian immigrants, were raised in a small town in Saskatchewan, achieving the professional and personal greatness for which we were destined, according to our mother, would require absolute adherence to the rules of the academic game. That approach served me well enough in the years that followed. Now here I am, a mortgage-paying, child-rearing adult, great enough. But watching my own son, I recognized something I didn't as a child. It was original, this willfully mischievous reinterpretation of the assignment. There was some artistry involved. Mischief has a reputation for causing destruction. The word itself derives from the old French mischief, which refers to misfortune, harm, injury. The Cat in the Hat turns up and makes a mess just when the mother is due home. Paul McCartney's troublemaking grandfather in A Hard Day's Night persuades Ringo to go explore on his own, putting the band at risk of missing its important gig. But then, the cat doesn't merely make a mess. He also balances a fishbowl on a rake while holding a full birthday cake atop his head. Paul's grandfather doesn't merely put the gig in danger. He also delivers some of the most captivating, delightful scenes of the film. As Ringo joins up with a 10-year-old fellow wanderer on the banks of the Thames. The best mischief makers know what they're doing. The destruction they visit upon their targets is always in service of some grander aesthetic purpose. For a long time, I've kept a mental list of the tiniest little mischiefs. In one, you buy the exact same toothbrush as the person with whom you share a bathroom and put it in your shared toothbrush holder. When your cohabitator notices and asks about it, act as if you don't understand what the problem is. Or if you both wear contacts, wait until he's asleep and then switch your contacts to his contact case and his to yours. If mischief is aesthetic, if it's an art, then it's valuable for its own sake. But it's more than that, too. It can be a source of stealth power in times of apparent powerlessness. It occurs to me only now that my own habit of collecting mischiefs actually started during my stickler phase in elementary school. Being an exanimatous child of immigrants, a social outcast, I lay in bed at night devising complex Rube Goldberg-like plans to confound my clear-skinned white classmates. Once complete, my mischief would have no apparent author. In a situation that forbids explicit expressions of intemperance or protest, mischief is the perfect solution. I had a classmate back then whose disdain for me was palpable. She excluded me from the group, generally ignored my existence. One year, our teacher celebrated each of us in turn by putting a poster on the wall with one of our names on it, on which everyone wrote words of affirmation and encouragement. When I thought no one was watching, I wrote on this classmate's poster, "Blank is rude." Mischief has often been a creative, anarchic weapon of defense among the marginalized. Free, adaptable, difficult to control. The trickster of American culture, Br'er Rabbit, was derived from southern black folk tales passed down between generations of enslaved people. Characters like him, the scholar Emily Zobel Marshall has written, could outwit plantation slavery using some of the few means available to them, their cunning, intelligence, and linguistic wit. Other traditions have their own folk heroes. There's Coyote, who appears in stories from numerous Native American cultures, and Anasazi from West African myths, Maui the Polynesian, Loki the Scandinavian. In my favorite trickster stories, in myth and in life, mischief even has a restorative power. Its apparent badness eventually giving way to reveal an inherent idealism of spirit. When Ringo goes rogue, he gets his camera wet in the river. Then he's chastised by a police officer for throwing a brick. When he first meets the 10-year-old, they start out tussling. But in all this chaos, you get the sense that Ringo is, for once, moving through the world according to his own aesthetics, no one else's. Ringo's parade reminds me of the way my son, during a kindergarten, spent largely online, made a point of interpreting so many of his assignments with unruly originality. Mischief shows us other ways to be in the world, by ways we might not have thought of otherwise. Back in elementary school, my note about Jay's rudeness was found out. I still remember her expression when my teacher forced me to apologize. Not rude at all, but bereft, stricken. She hadn't known I'd considered her rude. She hadn't considered herself rude. And from then on, through the rest of elementary school, Jay became very kind. Auni Vera is a journalist, an editor, and author of The Immortal King Rao, a novel. I'll read a letter to the ethicist. "Can I withhold medical care from a bigot?" The magazine's ethicist columnist on a physician's duties. "I'm a physician, and last year I took care of a white female patient in the hospital for a bacterial bloodstream infection. A few days into her stay, she began referring to black staff members by the N-word and to our receptionist by an anti-gay slur. As the supervising physician, I made it clear that this was unacceptable. In general, with challenging patient behavior, I find it best to clearly lay out expectations and the consequences for violating them. So before talking to her, I discussed the situation with her nursing staff and hospital risk management, and we concluded that if she persisted in using this language, we would discharge her from the hospital against her will if necessary. I made all this clear to the patient. Thankfully, she stopped and completed the rest of her hospital treatment. But if she had continued using racist and homophobic slurs, would I have been wrong to force her to leave the hospital? Although she was medically stable and we would have sent her home with oral antibiotics, a discharge would have been substandard care. Had she been discharged and not sought care with IV antibiotics elsewhere, there's a very real possibility that she could have died from her infection. Is hate speech grounds for refusing medically necessary care? I was taught in medical school that physical violence against staff, or the credible threat of violence, is grounds for refusing care, whereas rude, insulting, or mean behavior from a patient is not. Hate speech seems to me to fall between these two categories. Several black nursing staff members felt strongly that this is what we needed to do, and I felt it was important to unequivocally support them. I'm a Hispanic cisgender male. But the patient had a substance use disorder. This doesn't excuse her behavior, but it does put her in a more vulnerable category of patients. My assessment was that she was competent to make medical decisions, but I worry that her disease might have interfered with her ability to fully appreciate the consequences of her actions. And Mr. Appiah writes, the responsibilities of clinicians should be configured in the light of the long experience of their professions. But these are social roles, and given that we can all end up as patients and we all contribute to the provision of healthcare resources, society has a part to play in determining what they should be. What we've decided is that the norms governing medical care are to be primarily concerned with the welfare of the sick. The workplace environment should minimize avoidable injury and insult to healthcare providers, but not at the expense of that basic aim. It was entirely proper to tell this patient to stop using racist or homophobic slurs, language that's offensive whether or not it's addressed to those it derogates. And the black members of your nursing staff justly value a workplace in which they are treated respectfully. That's surely something every employee deserves. The question is what you should do when someone ignores this simple moral demand, and here your first consideration must be the risk to a patient of discharging her. This woman wasn't in your hospital for some optional cosmetic procedure. She was being hospitalized for a possibly lethal condition, and as you say, discharging her meant providing her with substandard care. Had you done so, you would have violated a central ethic of your profession, that every life is of equal worth, even the lives of those who deny that tenet, that nobody should come to unnecessary harm owing to a caregiver's decision. The reason you can discharge someone who poses a serious threat of violence to others in the facility is roughly that if we face a choice between seriously endangering Jamie and seriously endangering Alex, and Jamie is the source of the danger to Alex, we should prefer the threatened position to the threatener. We're essentially choosing between bad medical options, outcomes. In a clinical setting, knives should be wielded only by surgeons. That wasn't the situation you faced. Hate speech produces what some legal scholars would deem a dignitary affront. And a dignitary affront, however much we deplore it, is not a medical crisis. Your primary brief wasn't to calibrate the harms done by hate speech to the climate of your workplace. It was to ensure your patient received appropriate care, whether in your hands or others. Let me note, too, that the freight of words is affected by who's speaking them. Patients, perhaps as a result of sepsis-associated delirium or certain neurological disorders, may not be in control of their speech. People who are subject to Tourette syndrome, related coprophilia, should not be denied medical treatment because their words make clinicians uncomfortable. And your patient? She had a problem with substance abuse and employed language that is, increasingly, stigmatizing of the user. She had no power over the clinicians who attended to her and to whose decision she was subject. One indication of her lack of status is that your hospital's risk managers evidently decided that the institution could safely eject her without being held accountable for the consequences. Though they didn't intend to mete out a punishment that might have amounted to a death sentence, the risk managers effectively put the hospital ahead of the patient. The duties of medical professionals are demanding. In wartime, a medic can have the responsibility of saving the life of a wounded enemy soldier, even if the soldier has just killed one of that medic's friends. The fundamental clinical imperatives evolved collectively over generations shouldn't be hastily set aside. Clinicians have duties of care to patients, even odious ones, and the more serious the likely consequences of refusing care, the larger the burdens they should be willing to accept. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.